You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Mastering a second language as an adult is no easy task, but what if your job and your love life depended on it? Lauren Collins describes how that applied to her in When in French, Love in a Second Language, which Publishers Weekly calls a smart memoir on how the languages we speak shape who we are. It's my great pleasure to welcome to our show Lauren Collins, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker when she's not writing memoirs published by Penguin Press. Hello to our show.
Hi, Leonard. I'm thrilled to be here.
And bonjour. Did you study foreign language when you were in school?
I studied Spanish sort of nominally. I had high school Spanish, and like many people who have high school Spanish, I emerged with a firm grasp of sort of hola and gracias and crucially habla inglés and not much else. So I certainly didn't speak a foreign language before I embarked on this French study.
And what were the language classes like in Wilmington, North Carolina? Did they give you at least a good Spanish accent?
They were not what I would call rigorous, per se. We kind of studied the same thing year after year after year. And what that was the preterite. We would practice the preterite versus the imperfect as a means of sort of discussing the weekend gossip. So the teacher would say, you know, is it true that so-and-so kissed so-and-so over the weekend, preterite or imperfect? So I have a firm grasp of two verb tenses, but didn't emerge with a tremendous amount of Spanish otherwise.
Did you all have to learn how to speak standard American English as well?
That's good. I like how you threw in that y'all. No, I spoke English, but of course we had our little regional variations on everything. My parents were what were referred to as Yankees. Mm-hmm. And even something as small as my mother pronouncing a word like tournament, which we said a lot in March every year in North Carolina. No, that's right. Back in the day before the state took a turn, but she would say tournament. And the sort of local preference, the inflection was tournament. So I think early on I developed this ear and sensitivity to what it was like to be a foreigner in a language.
And then you moved to London. How did that happen?
It's a good question. I mean, the funny thing is the criterion was I wanted to go somewhere where they spoke English. And of course, 3 weeks later, I walk into a party and I meet a Frenchman, and then my best laid plans kind of all fell apart.
But the British don't speak English the way we do. They have all sorts of different words. Just try to get an eraser from a Brit, they'll hand you a razor blade.
Exactly. Well, there were all kinds of,
they call it a rubber.
Right.
I learned that in art school, my first day in art school in London.
Well, and you know, rubber, that one goes into French too, because of course they have préservatif in French, which is condom. So word chain there. But I call British English my gateway language. I mean, it was the first time, you know, I had to really try to speak another language in a way.
So you met Olivier at a party. I'm assuming that you originally both spoke in English because you were in London.
We both spoke in English because we were in London and because I spoke zero French at that time.
And did you decide that, was that okay? Wasn't that acceptable as long as he spoke English well?
It was okay for a while, and then it wasn't, for two reasons. The first is that we moved to Francophone Switzerland, and I suddenly found myself, you know, maybe having pharmacy French, going and being able to buy a bottle of shampoo, but not even acing restaurant French, really. I mean, I would order a salad and I'd finish it and I'd sort of neatly put my knife and fork to the side of the plate. And then the waiter would come and I would say, je suis fini, which in French means I'm dead, which is actually kind of how I felt there. So it was that, but it was also realizing that even though my husband spoke fantastic English, there was some part of him that I couldn't access without a grasp of his language.
And isn't Switzerland a bit more confusing because it's really a country with three languages?
Switzerland.
Did that apply where you were?
Well, Geneva? In Geneva, they only speak French, but Switzerland was
Geneve.
Geneve, exactly. Was sort of a great test case for trying to figure out what the effects of language are on thought. Because here I was in a country, I was in French, but I wasn't in France. And, you know, I had been living in England for several years, happily, ecstatically even. And then I moved to Geneva, and I was completely out of sorts. So it was interesting to see the effects of just, you know, linguistic displacement rather than being in a particular country.
Most English speakers can get along pretty well throughout the world because, at least in restaurants and other places, English is often spoken. But that wasn't the case for you in Geneva?
There was a lot of English in Geneva. It often had the paradoxical effect of sort of sending me into a rage. I remember walking down the street one day, seeing a sign outside a restaurant. It was for a hamburger restaurant. It said, Le Calamar, which was the name of the restaurant, in hamburger we trust. It hurts, with an apostrophe between the T and the S. It hurts so hard. And I just had this feeling of rage, of thinking, here I am trying so hard every day to learn this language. But yeah, English is everybody's property.
A former producer on our show married a German lawyer and moved to Germany, and he used to write a blog in which he would just find all the most hilarious English phrases around Berlin because they wanted to use English, but they didn't use it very well. But that works the other way, too, as you pointed out. You said, je suis fini, at the end of a meal. Isn't the conventional wisdom that it's harder to learn another language the older you get?
It's not just conventional wisdom. I think it's pretty solidly scientifically proven. I mean, one thing, the book is memoir, but it's also some reporting about language. And one of the most fascinating things I learned was that Henry Kissinger, we all know what Henry Kissinger's voice sounds like, came to America.
Yes, me too.
Wait, that was good. That was a good Kissinger when he was, you know, 12 or 13 and has had an ineradicable accent for his whole life. Now, he has a younger brother who was maybe 2 or 3 years younger, who sounds as American as apple pie. So there's a critical window for language learning, you know, not only for absorbing the structure and the grammar, but the accent. And it's really hard once it slams shut.
How did you learn? Did Olivier teach you? Did you take classes? You must have watched a lot of television, listened to radio to pick up at least some of the language.
Well, it was radio. Radio was the magic medium for me. I mean, the problem is everybody says watch TV if you want to learn a language, but don't, because, you know, there's slang, there are plots that you can't catch up on, the dialogue is really quick. I started out listening to Radio France Internationale's Francais Facile, easy French news broadcast every day. And I even had like a script that I would read along with. I did that morning after morning after morning.
They provide you with a script, and they do simple French
to
help
it's,
people
it's
like you?
Cultural diplomacy, exactly. But I did that, you know, forever. Then I finally graduated to listening to the correct day's news. I then enrolled in a class, you know, did a lot of role-playing, dialoguing, talking about foods and hobbies. And eventually it all started to congeal. I turned on the radio one day and I heard the man say a nest of songbirds in French. And after, I thought, if I've passed the nest of songbirds test, you know, something's happening here.
Did it ever put a strain on your relationship to have your spouse correcting your language?
Well, here's the thing. French people think they're doing you an enormous favor when they correct you. I mean, it wasn't only my spouse. It was his entire family, you know, really reaching out to me and telling me every time I used the wrong auxiliary verb or conjugated incorrectly. In French, to speak good French, they say it's en français bien châtié, well punished. So there's this idea, you know, and I understand it, that you're really doing somebody a good turn if you tell them when they've slipped up.
Didn't he even correct some of your English?
Well, this was the thing. Because I didn't understand his language and all the kind of deep structure and the baggage and the culture that went along with it, we would reach these linguistic impasses. I mean, coming from this American school of conflict resolution, like I learned to say, I need this. I want this. Not using you, which might, you know, impute blame to him. But I would do that, and he would take it as evidence of just raging narcissism on my part and that I was telling him what to do. So, you know, at a certain point, I realized that I was never going to be able to really understand him. I couldn't even hear his voice, really. I'd only heard him in his second language unless, you know, I jumped over that fence and went into French.
My guest is Lauren Collins, whose book is called When in French, love in a second language. It's those subtleties that can cause all sorts of problems. And you write about some mistranslations, both in your relationship with Olivier, but also in other parts of the world.
Well, my greatest mistranslation was very early into my apprenticeship when my mother-in-law sent a Nespresso machine for Olivier's birthday. And I took my French-English dictionary and I very carefully translated. I double-checked it. You know, I thought it was a beauty of a note. And I wrote back to her, and it was only years later that somebody broke the news to me that I told her I had delivered a coffee machine. As in given birth to it. So this was the kind of stuff, you know, I was trying to make up for when I decided I was going to go for it and learn.
You mentioned that President Obama was embarrassed for knowing only one language, but also say it can be an asset for electoral purposes.
Well, yeah, Obama said something like, you know, we all go over to Europe and all we can say is merci beaucoup. I thought, actually, you know, there's this strain of nativism in American politics. Remember Freedom Fries? Remember when we were trying to even slash out the word French, much less the language? So I actually think, I mean, American politicians tend to be proud of their monolingualism. Remember, there was a smear ad against Mitt Romney where all they had the, you know, the gotcha footage of him saying, "Je m'appelle Mitt."
They also made fun of John Kerry for being fluent in French.
Right.
But when you wrote a profile of Michelle Obama for The New Yorker, did you ask her if she spoke a foreign language?
I didn't. That was back in 2008 when I was still, you know, a happy monoglot. So that didn't come up. But I don't think she does.
Don't mistranslations happen in really dangerous situations like hospitals and courts? I would think that mistranslation in a diagnosis could lead to all sorts of real problems.
It's unbelievable. There was a man in Florida who was admitted to a hospital. Long story short, everybody thought that he had overdosed on drugs because someone who accompanied him had used the word intoxicado, which doesn't mean that in Spanish. It turned out he had a horrible accident. He became paralyzed and won like $200 million in damages, something like that. But it's a real problem for, you know, immigrants of any sort trying to navigate these really high-stakes institutions of law and of medicine, and it happens all the time.
You mentioned that bilinguals can feel like two different people. Is that how you felt?
I feel like a totally different person in French. It's interesting. I mean, it's the language, but it's also, you know, situational. It's emotional. In French, you know, I learned French when I was 33. I've been a mother the whole time I've spoken French. I have no childhood in French. And counterintuitively, actually, I feel this sense of kind of authority and self-possession in French. You would think that in your second language, maybe you'd be a little bit timid, kind of, well, bumbling, which I am, but reserved in a way. I don't at all. I mean, tossing around these adjectives, formidable, exécrable, that's, you know, in English, I'm kind of identifiably like a nice blonde chick from the South. And there's just a persona that I feel I can pull off in French that doesn't necessarily come naturally to me in English.
Did you give birth in French?
I did, with someone, with, you know, both my husband and the nurses yelling kind of, allez, allez, as though it was, it reminded me of the luge at the Albertville Olympics, which was my first exposure to cheers of allez.
I have an American acquaintance who's married to a wine negociant in Bonn. She speaks to her daughters in English, and they answer her in French. What kind of arrangement do you have in your household?
Well, our daughter's 18 months, so it remains to be seen. But yeah, I mean, they tell you one language, one person. So I speak to her in English. My husband speaks to her in French. And, you know, for the moment, it seems to be working, although there's the occasional crossed wire. Like, she knows au revoir, and she knows bye-bye. And I walked out the door the other day, and she raised her hand and said, oh, bye. But I think they say that it all kind of unscrambles itself naturally.
Do you dream in English and French?
No, I dream in English of dreaming in French. I mean, that's maybe the next frontier.
You mentioned that the prerequisite for speaking French is being the kind of person who speaks French. What are the kinds of people who speak French besides people from France?
So that's what I thought it was before I learned French. And I was intimidated by French. I mean, I think I wasn't a Francophile. I didn't have a passport until I was 19, Leonard. And so I think if you'd asked me about France, I would have said kind of unimaginatively, like, cheese, scarves, rude. And so that's part of the reason that learning French has been such an improbable and staggering, really, transformation for me, because I never thought of myself as someone who could master a language, who could go about my day-to-day in French, who would even, you know, be talking to my family in French. I just thought it was, you know, for these kind of cosmopolitan sophisticates, and I didn't count myself among their number.
You also write about seeing Bradley Cooper speak in French. He speaks very well in French. Not too many American movie stars do, I imagine.
Well, what it made me realize, so Bradley Cooper was apparently a foreign exchange student in Aix-en-Provence for 6 months during college, and he has somehow retained this, you know, really impressive command, not only of the language, but of all the body language, of the gestures, of everything that goes along with it. I mean, he was on the nightly news just killing it. And it made me realize that I think part of my hesitation about foreign language was that it's a performance in a way. I mean, I think I thought, this is for actors. Will I become fraudulent? What do you sacrifice of yourself in order to gain another language? But as I've gotten further into it, I mean, I realize it's not all about losses of translation. Translation has its gains.
You published a piece in The New Yorker, I guess last month, Love in Translation. This is an excerpt from the book?
It is.
Did the book start as a magazine piece?
No, it didn't at all. I mean, I think what happened is, actually, I thought it was going to be a totally personal project. I mean, I was doing this for love. It was for my marriage. And I kind of didn't want anybody to know about it. But then I started, you know, eating and drinking and reading and breathing and sleeping French. And when you're a writer, what's going on in your personal life inevitably spills over into your professional one.
You could have written it in French.
Not yet.
Maybe the next book.
Yeah.
When in French, Love in a Second Language is published by Penguin Press. Thank you, Lauren Collins, for being on our show. We'll be reading you in The New Yorker.
It was a pleasure.